MacCast, Tuesday, April 9th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we have a supersized show for you today. I can't believe how much news and information and things we have to get to, especially when it's sort of been a slow few months for Apple. I guess we got a lot of rumors, a little bit of legal trademark stuff going on, and then a lot of great questions and comments from you and some follow-up from some of the prior episodes. So we are going to dive into all of that in just a moment. But before we get started, let's take a second and thank one of our show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, if you want a new iPhone, you want a new iPad, you want one of these shiny new things, or maybe you even want a new Samsung device, I won't tell anybody, you can get one of those. Before you get that new device, or even if you've already upgraded, make sure that you go to Gazelle and you sell that old device to get cash. You can get cash for your old stuff, help maybe cut some of the costs of the purchase of that new device. And of course, you could give it away, but if you do that, you're not going to have that extra dough to kind of cover your upgrade. And the cool thing about Gazelle is they make it really fast and they really make it really simple. So you don't have to deal with the complexities of trying to sell it, find a buyer, going on an auction site or going through classifieds or something like that. They take all that hassle away. You just go to gazelle.com. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. You tell them a little bit about what you have, the kind of condition it's in, and they'll even buy broken stuff. So give them a shot. Even if you have a broken iPhone or an iPad, they give cash for that stuff as well. And they will give you an offer. And a cool thing about it is it's risk-free because they lock in that offer for 30 days. So once you get the offer, you can lock it in. And then when you decide, as long as it's within that 30 days to send in your device, you will get paid fast by check or by PayPal. And so do it today, because every day you wait, items fluctuate in value. So they're going to go down in value the longer you wait to sell it. And they lock that offer in, so that'll give you time to decide. It'll even give you time to buy that new device before you have to ship your old one off. So you can have the new one even before you have to get rid of your old one. And they pay the shipping, and in a lot of cases, they will provide a box. So it couldn't be simpler. And once they receive it, they'll process your payment quickly, and you will get cash for your old stuff. So sell your used iPhone, your iPad, even your Mac today over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I think it will come as a surprise to no one that when Apple releases a new product, one of the things that they do is they trademark or file for a trademark on that product name. And that's what happened when Apple released the iPad mini last year. And that filing has been going through. But the BBC reported earlier this week that Apple's trademark request for the iPad mini was being refused or turned down by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office unless Apple went back and added a disclaimer. So they were denying the application and they were saying, you have to come back, you got to add some additional information. And I'm no expert on this stuff, but based on what I was reading and some of the details in the report, it seems that what happened was that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office was concerned mainly with the individual words that were making up the mark. In general, they felt that taken separately, the terms that make up iPad mini were mainly descriptive in meaning, and then therefore would not be trademarkable. So they weren't going to let the application move forward. And they went into a little more detail and sort of broke it down in their explanation back to Apple, kind of defining what their objection was. And they basically said, if you look at things like the letter I in iPad, it's generally known by consumers to be a descriptive reference to the internet capabilities of the device. And then the term pad has become this general reference in electronics to sort of become synonymous with the tablet or pad computers. And then finally, they were adding that mini, and that seemed to be the word that they were most fixated on, that mini was simply a descriptive term for a smaller version of the device that already existed, meaning the iPad. And so the main concern of the USPTO was that Apple might try to use the word mini or the mini portion of their trademark at some point separately and assert a claim that, you know, anybody trying to have an electronics device with the word mini in it, well, we have the trademark, and so you can't use that with respect to your product name. And so that was the main objection, and they even went as far as to say specifically or give Apple the wording that they wanted to see on the disclaimer, saying that they needed to add an amendment saying no claim is made to the exclusive right to use mini apart from the mark shown. And so that kind of blew up earlier in the week or a few days ago. And then after all the publicity of the story, I guess it looks like the USPTO had a change of heart. And at least upon further review by their claims lawyer, they said that they withdrew their two main objections, allowing the application to go through, and Apple wasn't going to really have to do anything. But they still were strongly cautioning that Apple could fail to be granted the trademark if, one, there were earlier pending applications from other companies seeking to have their product names with the term mini in them. And if those were granted, Apple could run into problems with trying to trademark iPad mini. And they were also still advising that Apple should put in that disclaimer saying that it only wants to protect the term iPad mini as a whole term and not the individual words within that trademark. And that would, I guess, avoid any conflicts with non-Apple mini trademarks. So we'll have to see if Apple makes any changes or tries to push it through. They could potentially still get denied, I guess, depending upon the timing of all of this stuff. But kind of makes your head swim a little bit and hurt. Seems like the simple thing to say is like, no, we're just trying to trademark the term iPad mini, and then it probably should go through without any problems whatsoever. I think we all knew that in many ways, Tim Cook was going to turn out to be a very different CEO than Steve Jobs. And one of the ways that's pretty significant is he uses a lot more diplomacy or takes advantage of diplomacy a lot more and is also willing to apologize when Apple has made a mistake or, in some cases, as it were this week, even to apologize just for the sake of diplomacy. Tim Cook posted an open letter to Chinese customers this week to address concerns that had surfaced about how Apple was handling warranties on its products in the region. The issues began when allegedly the government of China began using state-run media outlets to engage in what many were calling a propaganda campaign targeting Apple. And the media was basically claiming that while Apple would often offer replacements for products in other parts of the world, in China they were reluctant to do so and were only offering Chinese customers repairs and replacement parts. And the accusation was that Apple was treating Chinese customers differently because of local consumer laws that require corporations to restart the standard warranty period on a product if they offer a full replacement. So basically, if Apple were to replace an iPhone in China 1 day before the end of the standard one-year AppleCare warranty ran out, then the replacement device would carry another full year of coverage. And so the allegation was that Apple had specifically not been replacing devices in China that they normally would have replaced in other countries because of this policy. So in the apology, Tim Cook basically did not admit Apple was handling any warranty coverage or replacements differently in China, but he did say that the company was going to make 4 changes to how they were handling warranties in the region. He said that they would adopt improved repair policies for the iPhone 4 and iPhone 4S, the two models that most of the Chinese customers or consumers, I guess, were allegedly complaining about. They would post a more concise and clear statement on Apple's repair and warranty policies on their website. They would provide more supervision and training of the Apple authorized service providers in the region. And they would offer a new feedback service to make it easier to contact Apple with complaints if you had any problems with the warranty system. And so while he did offer up the apology, in the same letter, he was also very quick to defend Apple and to point out that 90% of Apple's Chinese customers have expressed satisfaction with their repair and warranty services. And regardless of what you think, whether he should have issued the policy or not, it certainly had a very good effect, because just one day after the letter was released, the Chinese media outlets applauded Apple for their efforts to relieve tension among Chinese consumers. And the foreign ministry praised Apple for their, for, quote, conscientiously responding to consumers' demands. So I guess one of the triggers for Apple being singled out on all of this, I found out later, was something called the World Consumer Rights Day, which happened on March 15th. And in the U.S. and many parts of the world, most consumers aren't even aware that the day exists. But I guess in China, it's taken pretty seriously, especially by the state-run media outlets. The rumor I heard is that every year they tend to single out one company, and this year it happened to be Apple. I think last year it was KFC, and they kind of highlight a problem, or a perceived problem, or even a made-up problem in some cases, with a corporation, and Apple got to be the winner of that lottery this year, according to, again, some of the reports that I had read, and also a story that a listener pointed me to, actually a great podcast that you may want to check out. So if you want to understand the reasons why this all happened and get a little bit of perspective on this aspect of the consumer culture in China, or more the political culture in China, there is a podcast called Seneca that a listener pointed me to that covers weekly current affairs in China. It's hosted by Kaiser Kuo and Jeremy Goldcorn, and they had this week on David Wolf from Allison & Partners and Lori Burkett of the Wall Street Journal, who covers politics in the region, and they discussed the whole thing in depth and gave some insight from on the ground in China. So I'll have a link to that podcast in the show notes at maccast.com. I've bookmarked it. I listened to little segments of it, and it's very, very interesting. So it's sometimes hard to get a little insight on Apple and China and what's going on, and I think that episode kind of covers this topic pretty well if you want a little more in-depth information. You know, Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference is just a few months off, and this week we started to hear some rumors that they may be running a little bit behind on getting iOS 7 ready. As a matter of fact, John Gruber posted in a thread on the web service Branch that his sources tell him that iOS 7 development is running behind and that Apple is pulling developers from OS 10.9 to help out. I wasn't even aware of the web service Branch, but it turns out there's a pretty good conversation going on this topic amongst a number of really smart people from the app, from Apple Media, and so you might want to check that out. But the rumors are that Apple has really ambitious plans for the next version of iOS, and that some of those visions might be leading to some of the delays. I think it's possible that because Johnny Ive has a new role as head of software and hardware design, that he's starting to push his influence into the next version of the iOS, and he's probably got some pretty big ideas. But if you remember, his new role was taken on pretty late into the development cycle. It just happened at the end of the year last year, so they were probably already well into a lot of the design plans, so I would imagine that had to have them sort of backing up. And if they want to quickly implement some of Jonathan Ive's UI designs in iOS 7, it could potentially, in my mind, be leading to some of these delays. We've also heard there are some pretty ambitious technologies maybe trying to make their way into iOS 7. Rumors of things like biometric authentication, so you would have a fingerprint scanner on the home button. That's coming because Apple had purchased that biometrics company last year. And then we've also been hearing a lot of rumors back and forth about a potential payment system being built in, maybe near field communication, but at least some sort of payment system built into iOS 7. And earlier reports have been leaning toward iOS 7 mostly offering under the hood improvements, but more and more now we're starting to hear things that make it sound like that might have changed. I wouldn't expect any kind of massive sweeping UI changes because, again, it was kind of late in the cycle, but maybe Apple's rethinking that. But I have to imagine that what we're more likely to see are kind of smaller tweaks, especially to Apple's own applications, bringing in kind of a newer, simplified user interface, a flatter UI. And I would look to the changes that we saw recently in Apple's podcast app. I think that will give us kind of hints of things to come. But Apple, I know, is going to want to have something ready to show at least preliminarily to developers at the Worldwide Developer Conference. I would think they want to show both iOS and OS X. So it's interesting that we're hearing them pulling developers from OS X, especially since they committed to that yearly release cycle for OS X. So if their resources are running thin, it seems like maybe, and I guess it's possible OS X is ahead of schedule, or maybe they're pulling people from less critical teams within that environment. But I guess we'll find out in a couple months what they have ready to show us. And iOS 7 and OS 10.9, I would think, would both be expected this summer. iOS 7 running on new iPhones, and then OS 10.9 just coming out in the July timeframe on that yearly schedule that they committed to. But maybe they're going to backtrack on that. Who knows? But we'll certainly find out more information in a couple months. And speaking of the next iPhone, we continue to hear rumors that Apple is beginning production on the iPhone 5S, probably this month, with an impending release due sometime this summer, possibly July or August, which would fall in line with an updated version of the operating system. The rumors are from sources that have proven reliable in the past, so I put some stake in them, sources like iMore and the Wall Street Journal. And we continue to hear about production of this low-cost iPhone as well, and one that will likely have a plastic case and feature a 4-inch Retina screen, just like the current generation iPhone 5. What's unclear is if we'll see the low-cost iPhone along with the iPhone 5S. The Wall Street Journal hasn't given a hard date. They've just simply said that we'll see the low-cost device sometime later this year. And as a matter of fact, some have even questioned this rumor completely, claiming that Apple would just continue to sell their existing models like they have been at reduced price points to help fill in the low-cost gap. With the release of the iPhone 5S, that would make a $99 US iPhone 5 and a $0 to $49 US iPhone 4S. The trouble with Apple continuing that trend, though, would be that Apple mandated that starting in May, developers were going to have to develop iPhone apps and have app updates that would support the 4-inch screen of the iPhone 5, otherwise they wouldn't be allowed on the App Store. So Apple pushing developers to support a 4-inch screen would seem to support the idea that Apple is going to update all of their current devices to follow along in that form factor. So I'm putting a little more stock in them releasing a lower-cost 4-inch screen iPhone sometime, just like the Wall Street Journal has said, sometime this year. And there's also at least one analyst who is predicting that Apple will have multiple screen sizes of the next generation iPhone, the iPhone 5S. This is one of those rumors that I don't put a lot of stock in. I think it's just going to serve to confuse the product line. I really don't see this trend of bigger iPhone screen sizes continuing, at least not personally. But there's a lot of people out there that say Apple needs to compete with some of these larger screen devices that are coming out there. I think it would only add complexity for developers and for the App Store. And I think it would generally put off consumers a little bit. If you have to start to suddenly figure out, okay, is this app for this screen size or that screen size? Or, you know, if Apple can solve that problem in some creative way, and they have in the past, so maybe they will. But I just am not putting a lot of stock in multiple screen sizes in the next generation iPhone. And I'm a little bit backed up by at least one source that says this gigantophone trend is really just a fad. Well, they actually said the phablet trend is a fad, but I hate that term. Jeff Gamet hates that term. And I think Ken Ray coined the term gigantophone. So I'm calling them gigantophones from this point forward. But basically, Flurry Analytics came out this past week, and they had a usage report that showed that their data indicated that most of the devices out on the market that are actually being used to surf the web and do things where they collect analytics for are in the 3.5-inch to 4.9-inch size. As a matter of fact, they said that 69% of the devices fell into that category. Devices with screen sizes of 5 inches to 6.9 inches accounted for just 2% of their usage data. And so they say that suggests that the large screen phone sizes are not super popular. They really are just a fad. Now, a big difference in my mind with their report is that Apple's device is a 4-inch device, and in that 69%, it goes all the way up to a 4.9-inch device. So the data is a little bit inconclusive. Apple could almost have an almost 5-inch phone and still fall into that category. And then the other factor that weighs in here in my mind is that the 5-inch and larger phone trend has really just started. So it might take a few more reports before we see definitive results. But, you know, there is a big gap at this point between 69% and just 2%. So will that close up very much? Probably not. And probably that won't happen very quickly. Interestingly, the study also shows that tablets made up about 13% of the usage data, with 6% going to 7-inch to 8.4-inch devices, and 7% going to 8.5-inch or larger devices. So that seems to show that even with the popularity of 7-inch Android tablets and the recent popularity of the iPad mini, that full-size tablets still have a very slight edge, at least in terms of usage information. So it's another stat that I think is likely to change soon, but still very interesting. And depending on who you believe, there should be more full-size iPads hitting the market, at least very soon, or maybe there will be. Some feel that a new iPad should drop this month, but we haven't really heard too much on what exactly to expect in a new iPad from Apple. Assumptions are that it would include a new design, something that would look more like the existing iPad mini offering, with the black or brushed aluminum casing, thinner, and possibly with the reduced bezel. It also should feature a lightning connector and possibly a tweaked A6X processor. I would imagine it's possible Apple could introduce an A7 in the new iPad, but we've also heard that Apple's contract with Samsung is going to be up in June, and that they have been looking to move their chip processor manufacturing to another supplier, and it would be assumed that the A7 would be what they want to move over. So the timing might not be right for a new processor in an updated iPad. And because they did it late last year and we're moving into this year, we could just see this tweaked processor, something along the lines of an A6 with maybe better efficiency and a little bit more juice behind it. Recently, we've also heard rumors of supply shortages to the full-size iPad models, so that would seem to prop up this rumor that Apple's getting ready to do an update. We've seen retailers like Best Buy and Walmart also offering discounts on the current generation models, so both of those things together add up to potential indicators of an impending refresh. Apple is also likely going to want to get a new iPad out sooner than later, since they are going to announce iOS 7 relatively soon at WWDC in June, just like we mentioned before, and they will probably hold out the new OS to go on the iPhone 5 later this summer. They're going to want a little bit of a gap. So if they wait too long to get the new iPad out the door, they could end up shipping iPads with a dated OS just like a month or two before they show off the brand new one. And that just feels like something Apple wouldn't want to do. And I guess maybe they don't have to, because Digitimes is reporting that the iPad might not be coming in the spring, that Apple is getting ready to release it later in the summer. They're citing multiple unnamed sources in Apple's supply chain that they say are telling them the fifth generation 9.7-inch iPad won't even begin production until the July or August timeframe, and that would indicate a fall release, maybe coming alongside an updated iPad mini, which many expect to get an updated display, a Retina display on the iPad mini. Since Apple moved last year to kind of this split launch of iPads, we had the full-size iPad in the spring and then the iPad mini in the fall, They also did the Rev to the iPad along with the iPad mini. There's been a lot of question on whether or not Apple would continue the trend of a split iPad release or if they'd try and pull those two together. So I think this rumor has some validity, or at least seems to make sense, that Apple would want to just combine the iPad into a single launch for both versions. And you know, the fact that also iPad sales are still strong, iPad mini sales are strong, there really hasn't been a whole lot of competition. Apple's market share in the tablet space is continuing to go well. And the possibility of these delays in iOS 7, it may be that Apple's just decided they don't need to do a refresh right now. They can wait a little bit longer, polish some things up both on the OS side and with the hardware, get suppliers lined up and maybe transition more things away from Samsung. So they're trying to move their display business, they're renegotiating contracts. They might want a little bit more time, and I think they can take it at this point to do that. So I'm kind of starting to fall in line with, we won't see an iPad update until the fall. As much as that saddens me, I'd like to see a new full-size iPad, but I think we're going to end up with a better product if Apple waits a little bit longer. So I have to say, so far, this lack of stuff from Apple in the first quarter of this year has made for a very boring spring. And it's starting to sound like we're not going to hear a whole lot this summer either, that it's going to be late summer and fall when we're going to get hit with a whole bunch of stuff. And like the end of the year is going to be crazy, just like it was this year. I hope that's not this new trend, but it's looking more and more like that might be the case. And if this release schedule does turn out to be the new trend for Apple, where they kind of have light stuff going on in the beginning part of the year and they push everything, all the big product announcements and new updates, toward the back half of the year, I think we're going to continue to see mixed results, especially in their earnings for the first couple of quarters. And that's starting to be what we're hearing about as we move into Apple's second quarter earnings results call. Apple announced that that call is going to take place on Tuesday, April 23rd at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. And this is going to be the first earnings report that Apple has had after they changed how they've been offering guidance to investors. And it sounds like that's going to play a factor. If you remember, in the last call, Apple gave everybody a range of predictions rather than the previous kind of guidance they gave. They used to give kind of this conservative guidance, and then they almost always meet or beat that guidance. This last time around, CFO Peter Oppenheimer offered an expected Q2 revenue range between $41 billion and $43 billion, with gross margins set between 37.5% and 38.5%. He also mentioned that operating expenses are expected to fall between $3.8 billion and $3.9 billion, with other income and expenses coming in at about $350 million, along with a tax rate of 26%. So they're offering this new ranged guidance, and everybody's looking to try and figure out how Apple's going to do. So what are the predictions to that end? Well, on revenue, they're predicted to be right on target. Most analysts are expecting Apple to come in right around $42.77 billion for the quarter. The downside is that despite hitting that revenue target, Apple's earnings per share is looking to drop, which I think is not going to help their stock price. Analysts think that Apple will announce earnings per share somewhere between $9 to $10. That would be down from the $12.30 earnings per share that Apple announced in the second quarter of last year. So that's something that's very likely not going to sit well with investors. It isn't all that bad, though, since Apple will still have nice profits, and it's likely to continue to outperform the PC market in terms of Mac sales. And plus, if you want to believe the rumors, Apple should have a few new products out on the market very soon. A new iPad, new iPhone 5S, and possibly that new low-cost iPhone. So assuming they can keep their supply chain working and they can get those products out the door, then the numbers for the third quarter could move up significantly. Again, Apple seems to be waiting the back half of the year with products, a new trend for them, but will be good for their bottom line and hopefully ultimately good for their stock price. And even without a new iPhone in the market, Apple seems to be gaining in smartphone market share, at least according to recent Comscore numbers from December through February, Apple's average share of the smartphone market went up from 35% to 38.9%. During the same period, Samsung's numbers moved up as well, but only 1%, from 20.3% to 21%. So that's good news for Apple and shows that their growth rate is accelerating in smartphones a bit quicker than their biggest competitor, which would be Samsung. And even bigger news is that on the OS side, when you back up and look at Android as a whole, Apple's smartphone OS share also grew 3.9% year over year. But at the same time, Android as a whole saw a small decline in share from 53.7% to 51.7%. So Apple's gains have been a trend over the past few three-month periods and shows that Apple's share is rising slightly while Android's share declines a little bit. Android does continue to maintain the lead in total percentage, though, but it seems that the gap is continuing to narrow. So good news for Apple. And while Android continues to sell more devices, Apple still seems to have a larger lead in the web when it comes to usage on smartphones. We got latest numbers this week from Net Market Share, and they show that Mobile Safari increased its lead as the top mobile browser in March. iOS devices now account for 62% of mobile web browsing, with Android browsing coming in at 22% and Opera Mini coming in at 8.4%. Even more striking is the fact that last month, Mobile Safari accounted for 55% of mobile web browsing, rising 7% from the prior month. So I find it very interesting when these studies come out that they are almost in direct contradiction to the sales numbers that we see for the different devices. That, you know, while Android continues to sell more and more devices, or a larger percentage of devices versus Apple devices, usage data seems to directly contradict that. So just one of those things that makes you go, And another thing related to that is app sales. So Apple's percentage of app sales versus downloads continues to dwarf those from other marketplaces. We saw this week Canalys release a report on app revenues for the top 50 markets for March, and it found that Apple claimed 74% of the total app sales. According to the report, total app downloads were $13.4 billion for the quarter, with revenue from app sales generating $2.2 billion for the quarter. So downloads were actually up 11%, and revenues were up 9% from December, and Apple claimed the major share of that. The report did note that app downloads for Google Play Store accounted for a total of 51% of all downloads, but Apple making more money off of purchased apps. So Android owners for now are downloading just slightly more than half of the world's apps, but based on the revenue numbers, it's obvious to most that the trend of those apps or those downloads seems to be mostly free apps. And I think ultimately that makes a big difference in the health of the ecosystem. I'm sure a lot of those apps on Android, those free apps, are ad supported. It'd be interesting to see how those numbers work out in terms of revenue. But from pure app sales and payments to developers and things like that, Apple seems to still have the advantage. If you're going to make an app for profit, you want to sell it, you're going to likely look at iOS and that app store first until this trend changes. So I think that's good for Apple. That's good for developers. On the consumer side, consumers, I'm sure, like more and more free apps or lower cost apps. But I think if you want to get quality applications, you need to reward developers for their efforts. And part of that is buying applications. I think there's a whole problem, and we've talked about that, with app marketplaces and app pricing that needs to be addressed at some point. And so Apple's ecosystem seems a better place to start to maybe change some of those trends. And I'm hoping that's something that we'll see happen in the future. And from the little rumor that could files, I think I can, the Apple TV or Apple Television may get here this year, at least if you want to believe one analyst. Topeka Capital Markets Topeka, why can't I say that? Topeka Capital Markets analyst Brian White is telling his investors that his supply chain checks now show that Apple will ship a television set in, quote, the latter part of 2013. I personally haven't put much stock or faith in this rumor, at least not nearly as much as he does. But if his specs turn out to be true, it's going to be a pretty amazing device and one that I think a lot of people would want. He claims that the TV will have a will be a 60-inch model and that there will possibly also be 55-inch and 50-inch versions, although that seems unlikely to me because I think Apple would want to simplify the number of models right out of the gate. I don't think they're going to want to have three different devices all within just a few inches of each other. I think that confuses it. And plus, assuming they're going to sell them through Apple retail stores, which don't have a lot of floor space, they're probably not going to want to have to carry three different models of giant television sets in their retail stores. But let's just go with a 50 to 60 inch model of the Apple television coming out later this year. He also says that the units are going to ship with a 9.7-inch mini TV included in the box that would allow consumers to view content from the television when they're in other areas of their home. So over the network, it would connect, I'm assuming, using AirPlay-like technology. He says the mini TVs will enable other use cases, though, along with just watching television. You'd be able to do things like integrate home security, make phone calls, do video conferencing, that sort of stuff. So that does sort of spruce up the concept of a television and make it a broader device. In addition, Brian is also predicting that the iTV is going to have an iRing that users will actually wear, so like a physical ring that you would slide on your finger that would allow the television to have enhanced gesture and motion control. The gesture control would be in addition to also Siri voice controls. And, oh, also he says that it's going to have FaceTime as well. So a lot of amazing technology and cool stuff in these televisions. So you'd expect the price to be really huge, right? Well, this rumor just gets better and better because he's predicting that pricing will fall in the range of $1,500 to $2,500 US for the iTV packages, with the most costly packages including more mini iTV units. So you'll start at $1,500 probably with one iTV unit, and as you move up in price, you'll get more of the little mobile iTV units to go along with that television. So if that's happening this year, that would be amazing. I'm not putting a whole lot of stock in this one, folks. I don't think we're going to see a television from Apple until 2014, and I still think a lot of the issues are going to be surrounding content. So I have no doubt that these amazing devices are sitting in Apple's labs, that they have this stuff that they're working on. I just don't see them pushing it out this year, at least not with some sort of major content deals in place. And all we've been hearing about on that front is in the music space, that Apple's getting close to some music deals for streaming music services, but we really haven't heard much surrounding television and cable and all these sorts of things. So I'm going to say 2014 at the earliest, but if you want to go with Brian White from Topeka Capital Markets, it'll be sometime in the latter part of this year, probably in time for the holidays. And finally this week, the rumor that is voted to be most like a Terminator, it will not die. The Mac Daily News, not your typical bastion of accurate Apple rumors, but still a source. They've gotten a few things right, not necessarily on Apple hardware, but related to iCloud and some other things. They claim to have a source that says that they say has been right in the past, and that source claims a replacement for the Mac Pro will be here maybe even this month or next or maybe the next after that. You see where I'm going, though. He didn't say exactly when it's coming. He said likely in April. He also didn't have a lot of details as to whether or not it would be a tower or a mini tower or some other solution. So, in general, very vague on a number of points, but he was sure, almost, that it might, could, possibly be here soon, or not. Hey, look, since we've been waiting almost 1,000 days for a freaking update to the Mac Pro, what's another month or two, right? I think that Apple does have a Mac Pro update ready to go, and I hope we will see it soon. But at the same time, this rumor has gotten so old and has been said so many times that I'm not holding my breath anymore. I don't know about you, but it's just like I mentioned it before. It's the carrot that keeps getting held out in front of Mac Pro, Apple's Pro customers, and it's just getting annoying and, frankly, really cruel at this point. So I'm mentioning it only out of the sheer ludicrousness. Ludicrousness? Is that a word? Ludicrosity? I'm just making up stuff now of the rumors. And just to point out that, you know, the Mac Pro will get here, or the replacement for the Mac Pro will get here when Apple is ready to give it to us. And that is the day that I think a lot of us will be happy and rejoicing. And I'm very excited to see what they come up with. And I just hope and pray that it's huge, because after almost 3 years of no updates, it's gotta be big, right? Right. Well, that's it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, if you need to put together a website and you need to do it fast and you want to do it on a platform that is robust, that is solid, that is easy to use, you want to check out Squarespace. They have a beautiful and intuitive website platform. It lets anyone really create professional-looking web pages, blogs, and galleries, and you do it all on a simple platform. And they now offer built-in e-commerce. So if you want to sell stuff, if you want to sell digital stuff, if you want to sell physical stuff from your website, you can do it on the Squarespace platform and you don't have to go anyplace else. And plus, when you use Squarespace, your site is going to look amazing, because they have an amazing team of award-winning designers and user experience experts to help make your site look and function great. And then on top of that, you add in your content and they make that whole process easy. So you can put in images, text, you throw in your products, you can connect up your social media accounts, and within literally minutes, you can have an amazing looking website, and it scales and looks great on every device. So building the site is really just the beginning, because they have a solid platform for hosting. They also give you 24/7 award-winning support, and plus, if you sign up for a year, you get a free domain name. So you really get everything all in one package, and you can try it for free if you just go to squarespace.com/maccast right now. There's no credit card required. You can just jump in and start building and putting together your website, and it's gonna look amazing. And once you're done with it and you see how awesome it is, and you decide you want to purchase, you want to sign up, use the offer code MACCAST4 and you're going to get 10% off your first purchase for new accounts. And that includes both monthly and annual plans. So you can pick either of those, get 10% off. You just go to squarespace.com/MACCAST and use the offer code MACCAST4. Squarespace, they give you everything you need to create an exceptional website, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. On the last episode, I covered the story that T-Mobile, starting on the 12th, so just in a couple days, they are going to start offering in the U.S. the iPhone. And one of the big things that's happened over at T-Mobile is they've done away with any kind of phone subsidies. So they're only selling unsubsidized devices. But the way they're doing it is a little bit interesting. They are offering you put $100 down on the iPhone, and then you pick your coverage plan. I think it's like $50 and you get unlimited everything. So $50 a month, unlimited everything. And then they put you on a payment plan for the rest of the cost of the device. So you give your $100 up front, and then you pay another $20 on top of your data plan for 2 years to cover the cost of the phone. And my little pea brain just didn't work out exactly how that is all that different than a phone subsidy. So I kind of threw it out to you to say, okay, what am I missing here? Because I'm obviously not getting it. And I want to thank the many of you that wrote in to point out the subtle but very significant difference that I missed in T-Mobile's new unsubsidized service with phone payment plan model. And I think Kevin summarized it quite nicely in this voicemail.
Hey, Adam, it's Kevin Crossman from Fremont, California. What is the difference between T-Mobile's payment plan for the iPhone versus the other carriers that are subsidized? Well, you're right. For the first 2 years, there isn't much difference. But after that 2 years is over and you stop paying the payment plan, now you're not paying that $20 a month or whatever the cost is anymore. Whereas with the other carriers, they never let go of the subsidized fee. So if you upgrade your phone right at the minute every 2 years on AT&T or Verizon or something like that, you're right. You get pretty much the same difference. But if you spend 2.5 years, 3 years or more in between phones, for that extra period past the 2 years, you're paying those other carriers all kinds of extra money. So that is the difference between the payment plan for T-Mobile.
Now I see the light. Thank you, Kevin. It all makes sense now. And that is absolutely logical, right? If I just stepped back a little bit, I probably could have figured it out. I know I joked about having a pea brain before, but I'm fairly smart, I think, right? I don't know. Maybe not. But it all makes sense. And also, many of you pointed out that one of the big advantages is if you bring your own device. And for a long time, T-Mobile has made a pretty good business for themselves in getting iPhone customers who had reached the end of their contract with, say, Verizon or AT&T and brought them over to T-Mobile and given them good deals on voice and data plans. So a lot of people really like T-Mobile for that fact. And if you bring your own device or if you're willing to pay the full cost of your iPhone up front, then you are going to save money over the long haul because, like Kevin pointed out, you're not paying that additional subsidy fee on top of your coverage plan over and over again, even though you've met your commitment or you've outright purchased your device or can't come to the network with your own device. So long run, it is a much better plan. If you're like me and you have a new phone every 2 years and are constantly paying off that device, then maybe it doesn't matter quite as much. But I'm going to have to seriously take a look at T-Mobile. I wish their coverage was better in my area. And really, at the end of the day, I think for most of us with cell phones, what it comes down to is the service. How good of service and coverage do you have in your area, especially at the fastest data speeds that you want to get? And right now, for me, AT&T's LTE network is probably the best one in my area. Verizon is pretty good as well. And I think T-Mobile's coming along, but they have a ways to go. So I do like the pricing on their plans, but it's going to be hard for me to switch. But it's nice to have another option, at least coming up here in a couple days for iPhones in the States. Another thing we spoke about from the last episode was Apple enabling two-factor authentication for Apple IDs. And I think this is a great thing. But Andrew wanted to know some details about specifically what defines a trusted device and how does that whole thing work.
Hi, Adam. This is Andy. I have another quick question regarding your episode where you're talking about the Apple ID two-factor authentication. When we're talking about a trusted device like an iPhone or an iPad, are we talking about setting up the Apple ID with that trusted device, the hardware itself? Or, say, in the case of an iPhone, if I get a new iPhone, an iPhone 5S or an iPhone 6, but I keep my same cell phone number, is that going to play okay and still be a valid trusted device? Or, whenever I get new hardware, iPad, iPad mini, iPhone, next generation, how do I handle that with the Apple ID two-factor authentication? Because normally I wipe the device and send it into Gazelle or something like that. So I'm just wondering how to set up these trusted devices when they turn over after a while and we get new devices. So hopefully that makes sense and I can get a little bit more clarification on that. Thanks for all you do. Great show. Talk to you later. Bye.
Hey, Andrew. I think that's a great question, and that's actually one that's not really addressed by Apple. I did a little bit of searching. Apple actually has a page detailing the whole process of enabling two-factor, and they have some FAQs on that page. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it doesn't address this question specifically, but I'm going to go out on a limb and make some assumptions because you can add a non-Apple device as a trusted device using SMS. So if you just have any SMS-capable phone, you can put that in as one of your trusted devices. And so it's likely that it's tied to just the phone number and not specifically to any kind of hardware ID, meaning that if you get a new device and you port the same number over, you just can use that new device as your trusted device. You're not going to have to go and re-register it. It's already set up. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about the whole way that two-factor is set up to work. And the idea is that your phone, or they're more specifically in this case, your phone number, is acting as a second form of identification that relies on you having physical access to some sort of object, like a key that you would put into a lock. In this case, it is the text message that's going to go to the number on your phone. That's the key, but you need to have physical access to read that key, right? You have to have the screen in front of you. So as long as that code number can get to that screen, then you can use that as your second form of identification, your two-factor. And so if you lose a trusted device, what you should do immediately is go to the My Apple ID website, log into your account, and you'll have to use your second form of identification, the recovery key. Since you lost your physical trusted device, you'll use the recovery key that they gave you and you were provided when you set up the two-factor authentication to log in. And then once you're in there, you can remove that device that got compromised, that trusted device, take it off of your account, and then no one can use that physical device to gain access. And after that, you want to add a new trusted device, so another cell phone, another iPhone, iPad, whatever it might be. And then in essence, what you're doing is changing the locks on your account. It's the equivalent of if you lost the key to your house, you might go have the locks changed. Same kind of thing. You've lost the key to your Apple account, you're going to change the locks by changing that physical device. And what's cool is if you suddenly realize, well, I just misplaced the device, and you find it again, you can just go set it back up as a trusted device. So removing the trusted device and adding it back in is a pretty easy process. And so I hope that helps clarify things a little bit. The other thing I wanted to mention, for those of you who might be wondering, I noticed when I was going through that FAQ that two-factor authentication right now is only being offered in the U.S., UK, Australia, Ireland, and New Zealand. So it's enabled in those countries right now. Other countries are going to be added, and when they are, the only way you're going to really know is by logging into your Apple ID, going into the password and security section and of the Manage Apple ID site and checking it out there. I don't think they have any other notifications going out. Hopefully there'll be some press notifications that go out as they add new countries, and I'll try and mention those on future episodes. So stay tuned, or just keep an eye on the Apple ID website if you're in a country waiting for Apple to turn two-factor on for you. The next thing I have for you is a follow-up to something that we covered several shows back, and I actually need to warn people about a hack or a workaround that I gave on an episode. A while back, we had a back-and-forth discussion about how to enable access to iCloud syncing on older Macs, specifically Macs running Snow Leopard. And there is a way to kind of set it up both for contacts and for calendars. I specifically need to address how I covered setting up the workaround for contacts. I had a back and forth email discussion over the past couple of weeks with Scott, and he had followed that tip and he got syncing working in Snow Leopard, but then noticed that in his contacts, he started to see a lot of duplicates. So the iCal procedure, I think, is okay, but there are a lot of users reporting that after setting up the address book hack, they're seeing duplicates showing up, and a lot of duplicates potentially showing up in their address book. And I had tested out this tip, but I hadn't really gone back because I have it set up on my older Mac Mini that I don't use on a day-to-day basis. I don't go in and use the contacts in that Mac very frequently, so I hadn't noticed it. But sure enough, when I went back in, I had duplicates showing up. Luckily, this does seem to be a one-way issue, so the duplicates appear in the Snow Leopard address book, but they don't make their way back or from everything I'm reading, typically don't make their way back into your iCloud account. So that's a good thing. It makes cleaning it up pretty easy because you can just drop the card dev service from the address book in Snow Leopard, and all of those contacts will just simply go away. And then you can reset it back up. But again, every time you open up contacts or address book, excuse me, you're going to start to get and see these duplicates work their way in. And there are some hacks online that claim to fix the issue, but I tried them, and for me, they didn't work consistently. So what seems to be the cause of the duplicates are that any entries that you have additional metadata in that might be more specific to iCloud, so new stuff that was added when Apple updated the iCloud service and moved away from MobileMe, things like Twitter handles that can get inserted automatically by a scan through your contacts database in Mountain Lion, that information seems to trigger the duplicates. So I noticed that in contacts where I had that data, those were the ones that would show up twice or three or four times. And the extra data that I'm talking about shows up in the notes section of the duplicated entries because it doesn't have any place to go into. And so I think that's causing the card dev service to see those as separate entries or new entries or something like that. Now, I'm not a card dev expert, but probably someone who knows a little bit more about this could maybe figure out a workaround. Like maybe you can go in and customize, set up mappings for that sort of thing. But it all seems like a whole bunch of work. I think for now, what I would say the best thing to do is avoid using the hack altogether, or just upgrade your system if you can to Lion or Mountain Lion to take full advantage of iCloud. Again, you can continue to use, I think, the iCal workaround. That seems to be working fine, but I would generally avoid the address book hack. Now, you may know a more permanent solution or a better solution for this. I didn't find anything. So if you do have a fix and a way to get this working nicely without creating duplicates in Snow Leopard, let us know. Send me an email or an audio comment to mattcast@gmail.com, and I'll try and follow up in a future show. Next up, I have a tip that I think for many of you is going to change your life when it comes to using Apple's mail application. And I think I actually covered this tip probably years ago, and it's something that I've implemented on my Mac or have had implemented on my Mac for so long that I didn't even realize that I had this little hack in place. But in mail, if you're reading your messages and you click on the person's name in the header, that little drop down that you get, so when you hover over it, you get the little bubble, and you click on that and you have a bunch of different options. And one of those options is to copy the address. And that's great because it makes it easy to copy the address. But what happens when you go to paste the address is something that I find very annoying. You end up with the username, and then inside greater than, less than symbols, you have the email address. So where you probably just wanted the email address so that you could paste that someplace else, you end up with all this extra data, and it's probably not what you want, which makes it really annoying. And it is even more annoying because there is no setting in mail, at least publicly accessible setting, to change that behavior. Well, luckily, Fernando reminded me this week that there is a way. It's just not that easy. And once again, we're going to have to turn to our old friend, the terminal hack. We seem to be talking about terminal hacks quite frequently. Luckily, they're pretty easy to do. So if you're an intermediate to advanced user, I think you don't have to be really afraid of these little plist terminal hacks. And it's the ones where you use the defaults write com.apple. Whatever the preference file command is. And I'll have the specific command for this one in the show notes at mattcast.com. But basically, you type in defaults space write space com.apple.mail, indicating you want to change the mail preference file. And then the entry that you put in there is addresses included name on pasteboard, and then dash bool, B-O-O-L for Boolean, space N-O. So defaults write com.apple.mail, address include name on pasteboard, Boolean no is the command. And when you enter that in, that will change the setting. You want to quit out of mail before you change these settings. And then when you relaunch mail, it should, the next time you go to copy that, only copy the email address. If you want to change it back, you just change the no on the end of that command to yes, and you're done. And so, as I mentioned, I had done this a really long time ago and hadn't even realized that that wasn't the default anymore. But if you want to avoid the terminal hacks altogether, good news is there's a couple of GUI tools that you can use that have the ability to change the setting as well. One of them, my favorite, is Cocktail, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. You have to pay for Cocktail. Also, Onyx, which is a great utility, you can change the setting in there, and that one is free, and you can pick either one of those up. And for all these terminal hacks in the past, one of my favorite tools to use has been a system preference pane called Secrets from Blacktree. These are the same folks that make Quicksilver. And I've always had this installed on my Macs. You can go in and you can change the settings for all kinds of different applications, access these little hidden settings. The problem is that it's broken in Mountain Lion, at least for a lot of Apple's applications, including Mail. So it does have the setting in there, but I went to try and use it and it didn't update. And I couldn't figure out for a while what was going on. But what has happened is in Mountain Lion, because of the sandboxing, Apple has actually moved the default location of their plist files, of their property list files. They're now in your library folder inside a containers folder and then inside individual folders for each application. In the past, you would just go to home, library preferences, and that's where you'd see all your plist files. And still a lot of files for third-party applications are in there, but Apple has chosen to move their own, and I think that has broken the Secrets application because it's looking in the wrong spot. So when I changed the setting in Secrets, it actually created a new com.mail.apple plist file in the old default location, and that did not work. So just be aware of that. Secrets is not going to work for this, so use Cocktail or Onyx. Another thing that I found as I was doing research for this is a great website that has all of the terminal commands for the different applications. So if you want to find all of those in one place, there's an awesome website called defaults-write.com. Go there and you can just search for different commands. They have them broken out by 10.6, 10.7, 10.8. You're going to have to search for some of them because it's mostly like blog posts. So there wasn't really a way to kind of drill down and find specific applications or things like that. At least not one that I noticed, but still a really cool site and probably worth checking out. And then lastly, kind of related to this, if you notice when you're again reading a message and you look up at the header area and you look at the person's name, you may or may not see just their name or the name combined with the email address. If you'd prefer to see it one way or the other, there is a setting in the preferences that'll allow you to change how that's displayed. So if you go into Mail Preferences and then go under Viewing, you'll notice an option for Use Smart Addresses. When that is unchecked, it will always display the email in the header as first name, last name, and then the email address in the greater than, less than brackets. If you have that turned on, though, you will typically only see the person's name, and that's how I prefer to have mine set. So you can change that setting, but even with the Use Smart Addresses set to on, when you copy, the default copy behavior of email address is to copy the full name and address together. So if you want to change that, you are going to have to use this little terminal hack. But again, don't be afraid of these things. They're relatively benign. You're not going to do too much damage. But as always, you know, make sure you have backups before you do any of this stuff. And you can always just, if you back up the property list file before you make any changes, you could always just throw the old one back in and fix things back up. So it's probably smart to do that regardless. I have another mail tip for you, and this one came because David was asking me about a quick way to create a meeting or calendar event inside Mail without needing to open up the calendar application and copy and paste data back and forth. And he was mentioning that this is something that he would commonly do in Windows on Outlook, and he wanted a workflow that he could move over to the Mac that was similar. Now, David, I'm not super familiar with Outlook, and especially not the most recent versions of Outlook, And this may not be exactly the same, but I think functionally what you're looking for, at least in OS X mail, is something called data detectors. And you may or may not have noticed these before. If you hover over the text of a date or an address or a phone number or an email address inside the body of an email that you're reading, you should see an outline appear around it with a little drop-down arrow. And if you click on that, what'll happen is you'll get a pop-out with various options for doing things like creating a new contact in your contact database or in your contacts application if it's a email address or a person's name or something like that. If it's a date and time, it's likely going to give you a little pop-out to add a calendar event. And when you do that, you may see one or two different kinds of views in that little pop-out. You may see a summary view, or you might see a detail view. And you can click the appropriate button down in the lower left-hand corner of the window to change the view, or the little pop-up to change the view, to get access to fewer or more options. So very likely you want to make sure that for calendar events, you're in the detail view, because that'll give you the ability to go in and adjust specific details for your event. So if someone sends you, for example, an email that says, "Hey, let's do lunch tomorrow at noon," if you hover over the part that says "lunch tomorrow at noon," and click the little data detector, it'll pop up and it'll want to create a calendar event for tomorrow at noon. And then with the details turned on, you can put in things like the name and the date and the location. It'll sometimes pick that information up. It tries to be smart about what's in the body of the email and start to fill out some of the fields, but you can go in and you can tweak it before you actually save the item to your calendar. You can turn on alerts, you can add notes to it, so you can add a bunch of additional information. And then when you save it from the little pop-out, you stay inside mail, but that entry will go into your calendar, and if you have syncing turned on, it'll sync out to your devices. And I use this feature all the time. I absolutely love it. And data detectors are turned on by default in mail. And the only way, again, you can disable them if you don't like them is through a little terminal hack. So you're going to have to use Cocktail or Onyx, or if you're on Snow Leopard, you can use Secrets. And you can, again, go in and do defaults, write com.apple.mail, disable data detectors, and set that to yes. And that will disable them. But I really like them, so I see no reason to disable data detectors. As a matter of fact, you can get data detector support in other applications, and it may or may not be enabled in third-party apps or other Apple apps. If you want to turn it on, you'll typically find the setting in, say, applications like TextEdit, for example. If you go under the Edit menu and you go down to Substitutions, you'll see an option to turn on or off data detectors. And most of the other applications, I think they're turned off by default, but you can turn them on. So if you'd like to have those, one place where I haven't seen them, where I think they could prove it very handy, would be inside Safari. And I didn't see a way to enable them in there. So if any of you know a way to have data detectors or something like data detectors in Safari, maybe an extension or something like that, shoot it our way and let us know about it. But David, I hope that helps you out and maybe solves the problem that you had in quickly and easily adding calendar items inside mail without having to leave the application. And then finally today, I have a question that I got from Samuel, and it's one of these great questions for me that I don't know the answer to, but it's something that I'm curious enough about that I'll spend some time really digging into it to try and figure it out. It's one of those kind of puzzle questions, right, that you get that you're like, I don't know the answer, but I know there has to be one out there. And you keep searching and you keep digging, and hopefully you find the answer, but sometimes you don't come up with an exact answer. And in this case, unfortunately, it was the latter, Samuel. I wasn't able to find out exactly how to do what you want. Well, I was kind of in a way, and we'll get to it here in a second, but let me fill everybody in on what the question was. So Samuel has a really nice setup. He has a 2013 27-inch iMac. He also has a 27-inch Thunderbolt display on one side of that iMac, and he has a Cinema display, 27-inch cinema display on the other side. So three 27-inch monitors, sort of this full panorama view. And each one of those monitors has a set of built-in stereo speakers. And what he wanted to be able to do was break out the audio so that, in essence, what amounts to the three speakers on the left do the left channel audio, and the three speakers on the right do the right channel audio. The challenge here, though, is that on the left side, you're going to need to have the left channel audio coming out the two speakers in the Thunderbolt display, and then just the left speaker in the iMac. And then similarly, on the right-hand side, you need to have the right channel audio coming out of both speakers on the cinema display and just the right speaker on the iMac. And I spent some time messing with this. I don't have the nice setup that you have, Samuel, but I figured if I could get four channels of audio working, so I have some external USB speakers left and right, and then I had my internal speakers on my MacBook Pro left and right. If I could get the four channels and address each channel separately with the audio, that should, in essence, solve the solution. And I'll share with you the things that I tried and sort of what I discovered. And for the rest of you, I found out a really cool tip along the way, sort of a bonus tip that I get asked about a lot. And that is, can I send audio to both my headphone jack and my built-in speakers at the same time? And it turns out there is a way to do that pretty easily in Mountain Lion. An update they did to the audio MIDI setup. So that's where I kind of started. I started with audio MIDI setup and the audio MIDI setup application, because that lets you look at your input-output devices and sort of route sound in some interesting ways. And if you ever go into the sound preferences, you know that by itself, you can only send audio to a single location, audio output to a single location at once. And what we really needed was the ability to send multiple streams of audio to multiple different locations. So to do that, if you go into Applications Utilities Audio MIDI Setup and open up that application, you'll see that you have a few more options. When you first open it up, what you'll see on the left is the list of all of the input and output interfaces that are available to your Mac. And you can just out of the box select one of those interfaces and tweak a few of the settings, things like the volume or the bit rate. But you'll notice down at the bottom of that left-hand panel is a little plus button. And if you click on the plus button, you get two options for creating virtual interfaces. You can create an aggregate device, or you can create a multiple output device. And so the first thing I started messing around with was creating an aggregate device. And just an aside, I think multiple output devices were added as part of Mountain Lion. Before this, you would have to use the aggregate device option. And what you can do with an aggregate device is you can combine multiple input sources and output sources into a single device that will then offer you multiple in and out channels. So this sounded like the perfect thing that I needed. It was something that would make it real handy to create a single source interface that would have the ability to accept multiple microphone inputs, for example, and also have multiple audio outputs. But I couldn't seem to get the aggregate device working on the multiple output source side. Specifically, I couldn't get the system audio with two channels of output to work in conjunction with the external speakers with two channels of output. So despite being able to combine them together in the aggregate device, and when I did that, the aggregate device even said that it had four channels out, I couldn't seem to address those channels separately. I couldn't figure out a way to make it work. But the advantage of the aggregate device is that when you combine two stereo output devices, it actually shows up as a virtual device that offers four channel out. And I messed around with that for a little bit, but couldn't get that working. So what I did find that worked, at least in a way, was to choose the other option, which is to add a device that was a multiple output device. And in the main panel, what you can do is you can click on that, and then you'll see every output device that you have available, and you can select multiple ones by just checking them on. So I checked, in this case, my external USB speakers and my internal Mac speakers to add both of those to this virtual multiple output device. And then once I had that set up, I could tweak the individual settings, things like the main volume. I could enable something called drift correction. There's a little checkbox for that for a device. And I assume, I didn't find the details on that, but I assume this is something that would help keep the audio in sync with the master. Oh, and you can also at the top set the master output device. Basically, that is going to be the thing that you'll control the volume from. So in my case, I wanted to make sure that I picked as the master my internal speakers that allowed me to use the system volume control to control the volume of both those speakers and the external USB speakers. But basically, I put these two things together, and then once I did that and saved it, you can actually double-click on the device name if you want to give it a unique name. I think by default, it just says multiple output device, but you can change that. And you probably want to do that because once you've saved this device in the audio MIDI setup, you can quit audio MIDI setup, and what you'll notice when you go back into System Preferences, into Sound, and you click on the Output tab, is you will see that new virtual multiple output device in the list, and you can pick that as your output source. So what the system will do is it'll send audio to that, and then any of the devices that you have included in that group will get the audio. And you can go in when you're setting up the device and click on your speaker options and control whether the audio goes to the left channel or the right channel. The problem here, though, was because we were dealing with a stereo input and going out to stereo devices, they're seen as just left and right channels. So I couldn't figure out a way to get four channels out. I would basically have the two left side speakers having the same audio and the two right side speakers having the same audio. I couldn't address, say, like you would need both channels of audio going to the right monitor and both channels of audio going to the left monitor. But you could set up a situation where you have stereo audio going to all three devices. So left and right channel on the right monitor, left and right channel on the left monitor, and left and right channel on the center iMac, all with the same audio stream going into them through one device. So you have that working for you. But that wasn't exactly what you were going for. So that got me back to the aggregate device thing. And I thought, well, we need to be able to add another layer, something that will allow us to address the individual channels and route audio to individual channels and give us a little more finite control over that stuff. And I remembered that there is a piece of software called Soundflower that does kind of that, but also has a second component to it, something called Flowerbed, that lets you take audio that's coming in, break that out into channels, and then you can route those channels to different audio outputs or other audio devices or applications. So I started playing around with that a little bit, and I'll just give a word of caution to anybody who's doing this. Be very careful when you're routing audio inputs and outputs, because you can get yourself into some loops, and I did it multiple times, and my ears are still bleeding from the horrible noise that happens when you start sending multiple channels of audio to the same output device. But I'll have a link to in the show notes to the software. But basically, with the aggregate devices, what I was able to do is to take streams, audio streams with multiple channels, and assign them to specific speaker outputs. So that seemed to be the direction we wanted to be moving in. And it's really cool because it'll let you have multi-channel settings in your aggregate device. So you can do 5.1 and 6.1 and 7.1 stereo surround. So I know there's people out there who've tried to figure this out for their home theater systems. Look into audio MIDI setup, and you think you can set up some of these sorts of things. I was going in blind, so I was kind of poking my way around. But another thing I noticed was that there were geometric geometric patterns available, things like quadraphonic sound. And I'm thinking, oh, this would be cool for my example because I have four speakers. I want to send individual audio channels to each one of these speakers. So I could build a device and assign different channels, and I could have that audio flowing through SoundFlower. But the trouble I had was routing those channels, and I could do it. I could get it to work, but the quality on the USB speakers that I had had some serious digital artifacts. So I was reading online. It looks like there might be a little bit of a bug in the SoundFlower software, and that might have been what was going on, or it could have just been I wasn't understanding exactly how I needed to route my audio and my channel. So I might go back and play around with that solution a little bit, but I couldn't get it working, at least not in a satisfactory manner. And so then the last thing that I thought I'd try is I have Audio Hijack Pro, which is a great application. I use it for routing audio and recording audio for the podcast, specifically like my Skype interviews, so I can record the audio from my mic and also bring in the audio from Skype and mix that down and get that all into a single recording. And I use Audio Hijack for that. But one nice thing that Audio Hijack has is it has an effects panel where you can add in different audio processing units. And there's a bunch available in the application. So I started playing around with that. So what I was able to do was hijack, say, for example, my iTunes audio. So I started some iTunes playing. I hijacked iTunes. And then I went in and I started looking at the different audio effects units that I could put in. And one of them was an auxiliary device output. And what this one allows you to do is it allows you to take the hijacked audio and send that to a second output source. So I was able to say, okay, take this audio that I'm hijacking and send it to these speakers over here and send it to those speakers over there, or that output device, audio output device, and that audio output device. So that was moving me in the right direction. Then I noticed there was another audio unit available for something called a channel tweaker. And what that allowed me to do is to take a channel of audio and do stuff with it. So I could kill the left channel or kill the right channel, or more importantly, I could duplicate the left channel or duplicate the right channel. And with Audio Hijack and the effects thing, you can set up different sort of lines of processing, and you can process multiple streams, which in my mind ended up being multiple channels. And so I had three channels set up. And so what I would do is I set up a channel tweaker that duplicated the left channel on one line, a channel tweaker that duplicated the right channel on the other line. And then on the left channel, I set up an auxiliary device output to go to one set of speakers. And I set up a similar thing to go to another set of speakers on the right channel. And so I had dual left channel audio going to one set of speakers, dual right channel audio going to another set of speakers, and then I only had to get stereo audio then going to my MacBook Pro. So what I did at that point was I muted the hijacked audio monitor and set up one more channel in the effects panel where I just did a bypass of the main audio and then set up one more auxiliary output device unit to send that unprocessed audio to my MacBook Pro's default output. And then at that point, I think I simulated exactly what you're looking for in terms of being able to split the audio. So it involved a lot of steps and a lot of complexity, but I think in the end, I ended up with the correct results. Now, the only thing I didn't test is how long that audio will work for and stay in sync. To me, it seemed to stay in sync, but it could sort of become out of phase at some point because you are routing a lot of digital audio and processing a lot of digital audio on your system. So I'm not sure how robust that solution is, but it might be worth a try doing it with Audio Hijack Pro. So that's what I came up with. After hearing all of this, maybe some of you have some ideas or know of a bit of software that'll allow you to do this kind of multi-channel routing of your audio outputs. If you know of something or you have an idea, shoot us an email, send me feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And I look forward to hearing what you come up with, and maybe my whole story will have triggered some ideas in your mind. But you can try that stuff out. And David, I hope that maybe gave you some ideas that you can build upon. But with that, that is going to do it for the episode for today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of our show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can get more information on all of their software as well as free trials over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. Try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST, GoToMeeting.com. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, MacBook, Samsung Galaxy S, or other smartphone is worth by going to gazelle.com. Squarespace, the beautiful and intuitive website publishing platform that lets anyone easily create a professional-looking web page, blog, online store, or gallery. You can try it free. Just head to squarespace.com/MACCAST to sign up now. Plus, when you purchase, use the code MACCAST4 and get 10% off on your new account. Everything you need to create an exceptional website, Squarespace. And ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email attachments and FTP with ShareFile. You can try it free for 30 days. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. ShareFile by Citrix. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. A big thank you to you for your support. I love hearing from you. I want your questions, your comments, anything that you'd like to hear covered on a future show. You can send your emails and audio files to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MACCAST. Check out the Google Plus page or find me on Facebook. That's at facebook.com/TheMACCAST. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.